Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland. Welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. I have Eli Arnold back in the studio. Eli's running for Portland City Council. Most people know him from his presence on PPB Central Bike Squad, but of course he's not here in his capacity as a Portland police officer. He's here in his capacity as a Portland City Council candidate. Eli, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
So there's a lot going on at Multnomah County lately, and I've been paying, I love your Instagram still, and I've been paying attention to your Instagram posts about what's now known as deflection, which I understand to be what we formerly knew as diversion or drug court.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Is that right?
The thing you do instead of criminal justice penalty for drug issues.
Yes. And so the Oregonian had a piece about how Multnomah County's plan is to, and you did a great Instagram post about this, Multnomah County's plan is apparently to send people to these centers to get quote unquote drug treatment, whatever that might mean. Do we have a definition for deflection?
No.
And so that's part of the issue, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's not many details here yet. The only details we do have are really bad.
Yeah. Tell us what we know.
So, deflection is basically exactly like Measure 110, except, the police give you a ride somewhere. So you get stopped smoking fentanyl on the sidewalk. The police officer says, hey, do you want to be arrested and go to jail, or do you want to go to a drop-off center? And we don't know where the drop-off center would be. There's no details on that yet. Or is there one, or are there several? But people say, okay, I want to go to the drop-off center. So you put them in your car, this person who might have just finished smoking fentanyl, and now you got to drive them across town. And you take them to the drop-off center, and there is no requirement when they get there that they do anything. So they can just get out of the car, walk away. And there's no limit to the number of times that they can do that. No requirement to meaningfully engage with screening or treatment or anything else. No threshold for when, you know, you pick them up a third time in one day, and now we're just going to go ahead and stick to the criminal route. So I think essentially, basically, county is just trying to keep Measure 110 and just avoid the state's decision to recriminalize.
And what will that, what if anything, can the city do about this? I mean, you're running for city council, not county. What can you do about this?
I mean, the first thing is they are completely, they're either misreading or indifferent to what the will of the voters actually is. So the first thing we need to do is just bring as much public attention to this as possible. And it sounds like already they're starting to feel the pressure. When the, you know, the governor and the state legislature recognizes that something better be done because the public's getting very angry about all of this brazen use. And, you know, you have terrible overdoses happening. It's a risky thing to just blow that off. And that's kind of what they're doing.
I saw Dan Rayfield, who's running for Attorney General, as a he's a Democratic candidate. He did a letter about this, and my understanding is he was instrumental in the legislature in getting Measure 110 amended, and he did a seems like the adult in the room, fortunately, and did a letter to the county just saying this is unacceptable. This isn't what we planned when we recriminalized drugs.
Yeah, and I mean clearly he sees right how the public feels. So, we need to apply as much pressure as possible because this is bad for everybody. It's bad for the addict. And you know, one of the big problems here, I've talked to several candidates about this since who they like this. They want this. People who are, you know, kind of more on the progressive side who are just so concerned that there's any possibility of a criminal justice penalty. And I think the issue is, because I was a little confused, like, where, what exactly are we disagreeing on? And the conclusion I've come to is some people, when they think about this, they only think about that person that the police have stopped, right? And, yes, this person has an addiction. That's a serious problem we need to address. But they're not the only person who is being harmed in this equation. Because most of the time, this is going to be somebody who is using on the sidewalk, in the open. And not only does this person need help, but what are we going to do to mitigate the harm to the people who live next door?
There's people right outside here right now doing it.
Yeah. The lady who wants to push a stroller down this sidewalk, the business that this
trying
is
trying to go
front
to a
of.
Library. Yeah.
And so I think some people are thinking about this, and maybe that's because they're not asked to go to the part, you know, the place where the problem is happening. But so they're missing that other half of the issue. And yeah, this fails to address that.
It isn't, I mean, in my mind, as a family member of somebody who's struggling with opioid addiction, and you must run into this and see this all the time, the addicted person is also obviously a victim to me. And where is the off-ramp for this individual?
Yeah.
Where is the intervention with a really dangerous, really deadly drug? These people are dying on the sidewalks. In my opinion, I don't know. You see a lot more than I do.
I mean, I've, you know, seen people take several doses of Narcan to wake back up this week.
This week, yeah.
Yeah, and then just wander off down the street, repeating this cycle. So, you know, I kind of grew up without a familiarity with addiction, and I've learned so much about it since becoming a police officer. And, you know, it's a terrible thing. It's a hijacking of free will by a chemical compound. And people need help. They need something to help push them when they get to this point. And we ought to be able... I don't know why we're so afraid to ask anything of people, but we should be willing, when a person is ready and willing to accept help and treatment, we should get them there. You know, let's go. Let's put them in that treatment. But if a person isn't willing, if they're not able to help themselves like that, we should be willing to push a little. You know, we should be willing to ask something in return.
It still ends up being their choice, does it not? I mean, they can choose, under what I understand based on Dan Rayfield's letter and what I understand based on Max Williams and Betsy Johnson, who came in here talking about the reform of Measure 110, the idea is to ultimately still give them a choice about going through the criminal justice system or going through what we're now calling deflection.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think we're not actually asking them to choose between
deflection. Not under the Multnomah County system,
we're
right?
We're just asking them to not choose jail. But yeah, they can choose nothing instead.
Right, yeah. Right. But and then the other issue is that not that this is just going to eat up an incredible amount of police resources that are already stretched too thin.
Yeah, this is Measure 110, but it takes longer. And, you know, some other unintended possible side effects, a drop-off, let's say we end up with a drop-off center in a particular location. Are we now importing people in the worst state of addiction from all over the county to this central location? Like, what does that do for that area? If somebody, let's say, camps out near the addiction, near the drop-off center, can police really do anything anymore? You pick them, you know, you're two blocks away and you say, all right, you want to go to jail or the drop-off center? They say, drop-off. All right, I'm here. Right back to it. So I think we can ask for some attempt to engage, to at least sit. I mean, we're asking nothing. Can we have them at least sit and find out what services are available? We're not even asking for a half an hour of their time. And that just seems ridiculous to me. Here is a point for intervention, and we're just declining to make any use of it.
Do you have any understanding, as a city council candidate, what the arguments are for... I mean, I've heard the civil liberties of the drug user. I've heard that. Have you heard any other arguments about why we should leave people on the street addicted to fentanyl and not intervene in any meaningful way?
The only other one I ever really hear is that voluntary treatment is more effective than involuntary, to which I'd respond, any treatment is more effective than no treatment, and that's really the more likely scenario. And in fact, the people I personally know who have had serious addictions, who got over it, did so via involuntary, you know, a requirement for treatment. And I know some people who recovered and have led really good lives since and are grateful for that intervention. So I think it's a missed opportunity and something that we really need to correct.
What are your plans at City Council if this trajectory at county continues? What, if anything, can you do about this? You talked about pressure, but what does that pressure actually mean?
So one way to help address this, we really need to elect good people in November.
Yeah.
Change the composition of...
Well, I think it's Vadim Mazursky and Sam Adams.
Yeah.
As far as county goes, because there'll be county runoffs. And I don't...
And then with Vince and Julie Brim Edwards, I think...
Yeah, they're on for sure, right? Yeah.
So... better composition there will be helpful in dealing with these kinds of things. And, I mean, ultimately, the only real ultimate recourse we have is something like recall, which I am now seeing people talk about readily. But
It's too many signatures. It's tens of thousands of signatures.
It is.
I've looked at it. People have asked me about it. I looked at it. It's right there. And I've talked to people who do this for a living. You know, I talked to Kevin Sabet on this show, the three-time drug policy advisor in Republican and Democratic White Houses, about who helped get Measure 110 reformed. And we talked about a ballot measure, and it's just too expensive. The reason we went through the legislature, and Max and Betsy talked about this, it would have been way too expensive to gather the amount of signatures we needed for repeal. And we knew that the legislature was never going to refer it to repeal. This was the best shot we were going to get. And frankly, recriminalization of drugs is 1990s language. I think it's revolutionary. I was shocked that the legislature went along with the compromise that they did. I think that's all a great thing. They saw that Measure 110 wasn't working, even though we had the Drug Policy Alliance giving donations to people. I mean, as you know, even Mike Schmidt caved to pressure and said he agreed with the recriminalization of drugs, which is kind of incredible.
Yeah, real last second change there.
But I'm shocked he did it. I mean, he did do it. Jessica Vega Peterson the chair of Multnomah County doesn't seem to read the polls or be interested in them. But I mean, I don't know what kind of pressure we can apply. And this, as Kevin explained in that episode, anybody should go back and listen to it if they're interested in ballot measures and signature gathering and recalls and things like that, because he explains signature gathering is a really dirty business. It's very difficult to do when you have to pay these people, and it's something that I don't think anybody intended when they came up with these ballot measures.
Yeah.
Or recall efforts. It's an incredible amount of signatures we need. I just don't see it happening. So if that doesn't happen, you can withhold money. You can withhold joint office money.
Yeah.
Mingus Mouse voted to do that.
Right now, I think without some major change, withholding money from the joint office is the way to go.
Yeah, I don't know what else to do. And it doesn't matter. It's not like they still won't have billions of dollars to play with, because they will, and they can do whatever they want with that, I guess. So, Eli, what else is going on the campaign trail? What are you hearing?
Boy, there's a lot of things going on. Right now, you just brought up the Joint Office of Homeless Services. That's obviously a big issue. There's the discussion about whether or not to enter this new intergovernmental agreement with the county. And the new agreement is actually less advantageous for the city than the old agreement, including penalties for withdrawing now. And I just don't see a change in what we're doing that would tell me that, like, we've, in the 9 years we've been doing this, that, like, we're making progress.
We're worse. Aren't we worse? You know, I mean, everybody seems to be making progress but us. Clackamas County, yeah. Washington County.
We're spending more and more money each year.
Yes. Another billion, I think, this year.
And the problem's not improving. So at that point, you got to change the strategy. And so I think right now, county is so focused on housing, and they seem to only want to deal with that higher level intervention stuff. And so I think the best thing for us to do right now would be for city to take our money back and to do triage level addressing of the problem. And I think the best analogy for what's going on, I went to a forum recently with a bunch of candidates, and like
Portland State.
No, this was a different one, actually. This was the Northwest Industrial Business Alliance.
Okay.
And so, like, 10 other candidates, and everybody's like, it's a housing affordability problem.
All different districts or District 4?
No, this was District 4. And this housing refrain, I think, does a disservice. And, like, sure, one quote I heard from somebody was, the best place for a homeless person is in housing. And, sure. But we don't have the housing right now. So what are we going to do tomorrow? And to sort of draw an analogy here, if we had a natural disaster and we had wounded people laying all over the city, the best place for a wounded person is in the hospital. But if all of our hospital beds filled up, we wouldn't just leave everybody laying out in the streets and say, we'll see you in a few years when we get some more hospital beds. We would do triage level care. We would create collection points, staging areas. We provide basic level services there.
You know this from the military.
Yeah.
You lived in a tent.
I have.
Yeah, literally.
And this is how you respond to a disaster. We would do it. If we had an actual natural disaster, we would never just leave everybody everywhere. We would stage, triage, and then move people into further care. But we're completely missing that step. And county doesn't want to do it, so I would like to see city start with like a triage approach. You know, first things first.
What can you do as a city councilor? Because my understanding from people like Daniel DiMello, who is not in your district but is also running for city council, I think he's really smart. He's looked at that agreement between the county and the city, and you know, the county's job is addiction, mental health, etc. What, if anything, can the city do? It's like, if the city withholds joint office money, can they use that money that would have otherwise gone to the joint office for their own addiction path? How do you know what kind of powers the city has? I don't even know.
So we can spend money on things that technically should be the county's responsibility. And we actually are spending a lot of money on things that are supposed to be county. Portland Street Response.
Yeah.
That's a mental health response. That's clearly the county's responsibility under that agreement. We're doing it anyway and spending money on it.
That's a great point.
And the joint office. You know, it's kind of another case where this thing you would think would be a county responsibility, we're spending money on it. So we can do things. It'd be nice, especially since county is sitting on a lot of money that they're having trouble spending, if county would take more responsibility for funding some of these things. But I think that...
Or any, yeah.
We suffer a lot of the harm for county's failures. And the sort of uncontrolled camping situation, it harms the city, like, very directly. And so if county can't take care of it, it's just a good investment for us to do something to sort of end the chaos, stabilize this population, reduce the drain on ambulances and firefighters and police and businesses, and put some sort of order to it. And quite frankly, I don't think that needs to be a terribly expensive proposition. We're just talking about immediate, just bringing some order. So very quick, sort of low-level intervention.
Yeah, I think people look at this Clinton Triangle program, for example, which apparently is successful, but, you know, we signed that Urban Alchemy contract for a ton of money.
Yeah.
I don't know that it has to be like that. I mean, we need some kind of security, don't we? But I don't know that it has to be millions and millions. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we're probably going to end up using a wide variety of approaches, right? But that is that took a while to put together. It took a bunch of money.
Couldn't it be shelter first, housing earned? Why couldn't it be like that? I don't know.
You know, we can't pop those things up fast enough. And
I agree.
And quite frankly,
and we do it in an ice storm. We do it in 10 seconds.
Yeah. We can create that basic, here's a place for you to be.
Yeah.
Without too much difficulty and without the tremendous cost. So let's do that. And quite frankly, some people will likely just decide, I don't want to follow the rules. I can just go back to couch surfing. I can move back to this other town. There are people who absolutely are camping on streets in Chinatown because they're allowed to camp on streets in Chinatown, who would discontinue it.
Oh, so, you think they would discontinue it?
Some people would. Some people, you know, say they have an addiction. Well, I can give myself fully over to this addiction, not pay rent, live out here, and this is tolerated and will work for me. I know people like that.
I know people who've been given
housing, who've been given housing repeatedly, who choose to still live on the street instead.
That's what Andrea Suarez from We Heart Seattle says. Yeah, you give, I mean, they get an apartment, they're back out on the street because of drugs or mental illness or whatever. It works for a small fraction.
Or they just like that lifestyle. I know a guy right now, he just lost his housing because he wouldn't stop smoking inside of his apartment. He's a pretty healthy guy. I've known him for years in Old Town. But he kind of, you know, I don't know. He just wasn't willing to do that thing to stay in housing. Now, if somebody just needs some intervention, you're a single mom, you're having trouble making rent, whatever, great. Let's intervene to help people who can accept that help. But, you know, there are other cases. It's not just housing affordability. There's severe addiction, mental illness, or sometimes some other issues. And those require a different approach.
What do we do about that, the issue that you talked about the drop-off center? Let's say we're going to build shelters. I know that initially, at least, one of Dan Ryan's plans as a city councilor, when he was in charge of these safe rest villages, was to put them in neighborhoods. Some of them went in, a lot of neighborhoods. If they had the ability, they fought it. Where do these shelters go? Because I'm assuming they're all no barrier. And we erect these shelters and we put people everywhere. I mean, is it just like an ice storm situation where we take, commercial real estate and gymnasiums and things and city properties that aren't, I guess the county usually does it, but that aren't being used? Like, they usually open up warming shelters.
Yeah, so for sort of that first level shelter thing.
Yeah,
I think spread through the city, kind of like camping is. So we're not going to concentrate for anybody. Spread through the city, there are a ton of properties that the city has control of and access to where you can say, all right, the 20 tents that are in this neighborhood, we're not allowing camping on public land anymore, but we have this spot. You can go here. We'll drop a porta potty and a dumpster. And
it's no barrier.
I mean, it's public land, so it's got all the rules any other public land has. But I don't think...
So most people may choose not to. Do we know? I mean, we don't know. We haven't really performed that experiment, have we?
We'll choose what?
We'll choose shelter. We haven't really performed that experiment, have we?
I mean, I think when...
Unless we do a sweep.
When we have a rule and we enforce it, then people will choose it.
Yeah, which we don't really do, right? I mean, you would know. I don't... You probably supervise those quote-unquote sweeps, which they actually really, I don't think, are. They have to give them notice. Yeah. They have to give them somewhere to go. I think the last time they counted out how many people went, it was... You would know this better. It wasn't the majority.
No, it's not very many. And really, people get all worked up about this. They post 3 days prior.
3 days, yeah.
And say, hey, you got to move 2 blocks so we can clean. And then if you don't move in those 3 days, then they come and they go, hey, again, you got to move.
Yeah, start ripping it up, right?
No. They and then when the people refuse, if they have issues, then they call police. Then we come try to negotiate with them. And basically, eventually, everybody moves and they clean up stuff.
And they just move a couple blocks away, do they not? I mean, there's
2 blocks. So it
you
really
probably
is
watch
cleaning
them set up.
And there are a lot of tents out there that are storage tents, or that are used and abandoned, or like there are things that need cleaning up. They're not all inhabited, so it actually is good at managing kind of the trash and some of the negative things that kind of come along with it.
Yeah, if you we saw in COVID, if you let that stuff sit, it's over. I mean, there's going to be like a 3-story pallet structure in no time. And where to begin? I mean, you know what that was like. I mean, I remember looking around just thinking, I don't even know where you'd start. They seem to have done a pretty good job with Pride, for example. And since we're on the subject of Pride for a second, I want to talk about your Instagram post about your son, right? It was your son?
Yeah.
That was a beautiful... Can you talk at all about that? Because I thought that was a really beautiful story.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm going to get emotional. I have a 19-year-old son, and I think in 2019, they asked police officers, you know, who had family members or were themselves part of the community if they wanted to march in the Pride Parade. And so I asked my son. He said he did. So we went down there. Got to go in uniform. And, yeah, it was just really nice. We lived a long time in, like, in the South, in some places where it was not socially acceptable to be gay. And it was just so positive, you know. And as a parent, just, you know, have people cheering your kid.
Yeah. And supporting him in a, probably in a way that he hadn't felt supported or not collectively like that.
You know, I don't even know if it hit him as much as it hit me, because he was younger and, you know.
Yeah.
We don't have any issue with it, so.
Yeah.
But as a parent, it was very nice to feel that. Yeah.
I think it's one of the best things about Portland.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you want a place where people are free. Like, life's hard. Pick your own way to go
through
it.
That's exactly right. And we're pretty good about that here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the few things we seem to do well in regard to letting people do what they want. And it, in fact, I'm embracing them. Yeah. So it was probably really sweet to see.
It was a really great experience.
And it's great to have a police community that supports the gay community, and probably in that, I don't know that every police community in the South is going to march in the Pride Parade. Maybe they do. I don't know. I don't know. You would know better than me on that too. I've never lived anywhere but the Pacific Northwest, so that's a luxury. But you would know. You hear a lot about the police and what they believe or what they don't believe. And I thought that was a very touching story just about your family, but also a touching story about Portland Police Department.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, people draw a lot of conclusions, you know, based on limited experience. And so I hope one benefit of my running in this race is simply the chance to let a bunch of people in the city know one police officer better. Yeah. And sometimes I do run into, you know, I run into a lot of people assuming that they know where I'm coming from. And so, yeah, nice to let them know there's more
variety.
Nice
to break that stereotype. And, yeah, that's right. So what else are you seeing out and about on the campaign trail, and what issues are you interested in bringing education to your district about?
So one thing I think about a lot is how the new system works. The logic, the strategy that plays out in a totally new type of election that I've never participated in one like before. And I've come to some conclusions. And I think a lot of people have not internalized some of this. So I'll hear people say things like, we've got to pick the right three. And
yes, we were talking about that even off mic, and that seems to be the default position of everybody I've talked to. Like, who is our three going to be for ranked choice voting when it comes time to vote for city council candidates in November?
Yeah, and I would advise people to think about it this way. You will only ultimately help elect one person. You're going to get ranks, so you get six chances to put your vote toward a person who will be among that three. But you will not contribute votes to three different people, and you will not get three ideologically similar candidates. So the real benefit of the new system, the thing that is cool about it, is before you'd have a race and it would end up 51-49, right? 51% of the people are happy, help put somebody who will represent them, hopefully, on city council, and the other 49% are sad.
And there was a primary, yeah. And so people would either, it was just like, that we saw with county this last election, people would get through the primary or they wouldn't.
Yeah. So under the new system, at least 75% of the public will have placed a vote towards somebody who is now on council. So
is that true? What about single transferable vote? Doesn't that screw it all up?
No. Like, so to win a seat, you need 25% plus one.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
I hope so.
Who'd you hear that from? Because that's not what I'm hearing. Based on single transferable vote.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding of it?
Yeah. That's your win threshold, 25% plus one.
Have you heard, here's a question.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything from Multnomah County elections about this?
About
single transferable vote and how they think, I mean, that's really who needs to come in here. Single transferable vote and how they think that's going to work, because isn't it sort of dependent? My understanding from talking to like Daniel, people like Daniel DeMello is like a software guy, kind of numbers guy, and Bob, who's running for city council in your district 2 and district 4, who was very into this whole charter reform process. Who's going to build the software for this, and what is their understanding of single transferable vote?
Yeah.
I mean, do we know that it's 25% plus one?
That's how it's supposed to work. Yeah. We'll see the breakdown. There's, you know, we're supposed
will
to be able
we?
To see
I mean,
it.
I don't know that we will, but I hope, you know, I hope and pray. I enjoy everything that you're saying, and I'm hopeful that all of that is right.
Yeah.
And if that's true, then I think you're right. I think that is cool, but
so
is that where you were going with that about how do people decide who to write down?
Well, no, you apply one vote, and if that person gets eliminated, you will now apply your one vote to another person, and it will keep going like that. And as long as you don't have all six eliminated, your vote will be applied to one person. So you're not helping elect three. Your vote will only go.
That is important.
So I would like people to instead think about who is the one person I most want to see on this council. And if I can't get that one, then who? And sort of think about it that way, because you're not getting the three. And I would imagine your district, right? Imagine the population there kind of broken down into, I don't know, little blocks, like ideological blocks, right? So if somebody, let's say somebody is super progressive, they're probably not going to put their number one super progressive person, their number two, I don't know, like minimal government person. And, you know, they're not going to jump around. They're going to rank between the multiple candidates who like exist in that ideological space that they exist in.
I'm worried people are just going to start listing people, even if they don't. I mean, what Vadim says is don't rank anybody that you don't want to see on city council. Just stop.
Yeah.
Like you said, pick the one or pick the ones. If you want to see six, great, then list them all. But like you said, Eli, list them in order.
Oh, yeah. The order is super important.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Very, very important. So, well, let me go first here.
Yes, please.
Let's imagine three lanes. And so for most places, let's imagine a progressive lane. People who identify in there will look at the candidates in there and probably rank their six out of that, right? And then let's say a conventional Portland politics lane, somebody who looks like Ted Wheeler or, you know, somebody who's currently on city council. I'd imagine that
God
is kind
help
of a
us.
Lane. And they will probably split their six, right? They'll rank out candidates who are in that ideological space. And then I think there's also like I'm kind of fed up and I'm concerned about homelessness and crime and public safety and all these things.
Yeah.
And then they will do the same. So we've got these three lanes, and what will happen through the rounds is that each of these will reduce to one final candidate, right? So whoever...
That's how you see this ultimately ending up in every district.
Yeah. And some districts may have enough space in a lane, like say the conventional lane, that two candidates could get elected out of there.
It depends on the demographics of your district.
Yeah. This is all kind of district dependent, how big these lanes are. But they will reduce to one. So if you have five progressive candidates in there, the one with the fewest first place votes disappears first. So those first place votes matter a lot because that's how you survive rounds. So you want to make sure that the person you most want gets the first place vote, because you could be a person who has very strong support from, let's say, 10% of the population, right? But you have no, like, broad support. You got no second place, no third place votes, nothing. And you got another candidate who starts out with 9% first place votes, but 80% of the people put them down as second place. That person will be eliminated. So you really need the first place votes to survive rounds.
That's really, I don't think anybody knows this. Are you making this education? I hope you're making it part of your campaign trail information. Is there anybody doing this kind of information that we should be tuning into?
Just as like an example of how it works, I think Rose City Reform shared a video that had some puppets the other day. That was good.
Maya Harris, I think.
But I think I'm at least trying to go a little beyond into, you know, kind of what is the strategy and what does this look like beyond, like, mechanistically, but... Yeah, how do we think about this?
Well, Willamette Week couldn't come up with it. I mean, they tried to do a cartoon, and every single... the best part was the charter commissioners. They asked the charter commissioners how single transferable vote was going to work, and they all gave different answers.
Yeah.
So, that's part of my nervousness about that. But if you're right, and people think... people are saying it is going to be this 25%, then so with the two rules you're saying are, I mean, it doesn't matter, no matter how it ends up, the two rules, it sounds like, that have been consistent that I've heard about from anybody who knows anything about it is, yes, number one needs to be chosen carefully, but also don't write anybody down who you absolutely don't love and wouldn't kill to see on city council. Just stop. Put your pencil down.
I mean, I don't know, that comes into, like, do you want to have a say in, like, the lesser of evils, you know, or... I mean, I think there's an argument for that.
Really? Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Can you live with yourself?
You do what you want to do down the line. But.
I guess. Well, what... Yeah, if you're a pragmatist, what is your advice about that? I didn't think about that.
That's how I think about it.
That's a good... I mean, that's the best way to think about it. Oh, are you really?
I want to have a say in...
Yeah.
As long as I can. You know, there's a...
I think that's probably smart.
Only slightly related, but there's an old, there was an old pilot, an experimental test pilot from a long time ago, and this guy crashed so many planes. And when I was in flight school, this was a guy that was talked about, and his policy was fly as deep into the crash as you can.
He survived all these. Yeah. Apparently.
I don't know if he eventually died, but he survived a lot of them. But, you know, you keep trying to make inputs until you lose all power to make inputs. So
I understand. That's not a bad strategy. So another strategy, it sounds like, is you, but gosh, Eli, people are going to have to prep for this. Like it's a graduate school exam or something. I mean, there's so many candidates.
There are. And so I think a huge challenge is going to be people don't have enough bandwidth for 20 candidates, and all the mailers are going to be getting and all the rest of this. And so a big thing, obviously, that I feel like I need to do is break out of that noise a little bit and just, you know, keep it focused and, you know, because there's so many, people aren't going to have time to, like, delve deeply into all these different people.
Well, and you're going to a lot of these forums because you're a candidate. What is, if you're just a member of the public, what do you do? What is the best way to educate yourself about all these people? Is it a candidate forum? Do you need to go to a candidate forum? Maybe you do.
If I was a member of the public.
Yeah.
And I was going to take some time. Interesting to look at people's websites and follow their social media is probably the lowest effort way to just get a sense of where they're coming from.
Great idea. Yeah.
Because, you know, some you're gonna pop onto that front page of the website and be like immediate no or so, you know, you should be able to process of elimination this down to a smaller number. Think about what your priorities are, which of these lanes do you fall into and which candidates fall into there, and then start paying attention to those ones.
Yeah, what are your issues?
Because really it's about ranking the ones that fit into that same space you fit into.
I think this is all great advice. Social media just seems to be the path of least resistance. Just start following all these people, and you'll find out. You're exactly right. You'll find out in about a week what their priorities are.
Yeah. And I think it's just the lowest effort way to get fed information.
And people don't have time.
Help you rank and eliminate.
So what else is on your mind? What else is going on?
I went to the Rosarians milk carton boat race yesterday.
I saw that. Yeah. What happened? It stayed afloat.
Oh, yeah.
I know that.
Boat did great, thankfully. And I did not have seasoned paddlers out there, but they seemed to figure it out with some yelling how to steer it. But, you know, it's just such a cool event, and
it's
I've
so
wanted
cool.
to do it for years. We got COVID one year, like right when we were going to put a boat in, but... Everybody got sick back in like 2021. So finally, it was a real rush to fit it in with all the other things I'm doing.
Yeah, I don't know how you... I saw your Instagram post about how you were going to do it. And I just thought, oh my gosh. Because you don't have enough to do. But you all did it. You all did it.
Yeah, we just slammed it together. But it was such a nice, you know, family-friendly, healthy community kind of event. There were hundreds and hundreds of people out there. And it's nice to see those things...
It is.
And you know, that's what success looks like. That's what we want to return to get that feel more and more often where we live.
That's a great
pleasure
example.
To participate.
That's a great example. I saw Renee Gonzalez posted about doing a Special Olympics event, which I thought was really great too. And he did. Did you do the, like, any of the Rose Parade stuff with your family at all?
No, I didn't make it to any of the Rose. Oh, but I did work actually some of the Rose Parade stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And so that's always cool to see. I don't know about everybody, but a lot of people tend to come out for that.
The Junior Rose Parade and the Starlight, I normally make it too.
Yeah.
I didn't make Starlight this year, but I did make the Junior. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's nice.
It is nice, and everybody seems happy. And people seem pretty happy with Pride, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my observation.
You know, I think there's something else I've been thinking about this kind of goes into. And I've been thinking about, because of the way people tend to assume what my beliefs are, how to very tightly convey where I come from. And I was thinking about sort of the... key event for me in how I think politically was in 2005. I grew up in kind of a conservative, you know, family, and I moved to Germany, and the army stationed me there. And I very immediately came to some like new conclusions, you know. And the reason was because I looked at the lives Germans were living, and the results, the outcomes, were very convincing to me. And I think. The problem here in Portland right now is that we have become so focused on the declarations and the performance and indifferent to the outcomes. And I think Portland, a lot of people have this deep desire to like export our values to show people that like we know how it ought to be done. But the way you win people over, it's with outcomes. It's by building something that is enviable, you know, something you want to emulate. And that's the way, to quietly build something. That is attractive. And I think stuff like the milk carton boat race, like that's what people want. That's what you want to see where you live.
Yeah, I wish we had more things like that downtown, actually, because I think it would bring more foot traffic. And I think it would deter people from doing everything they're doing around this building right now and, you know, just smoking and dealing drugs in this bizarre public way. The more people that are downtown, I think the more we deter from things like that. And I wish we had more downtown Rose Parade style events, or it doesn't need to be a milk carton race, but it, you know, it certainly could, we could do something with that super fun site of the Willamette. Hopefully there's still dragon boat stuff going on, but
I think they just had that.
Yeah. I mean, that's stuff like that is great. I wish we had more things like that. And downtown seems to be doing better when we have these summer events. It's just, it seems, you would know better than I do because you're walking and riding all around these places. But it seems to be more cleaned up and just in general, literally less trash.
It's taken a lot of effort over the last couple of years. And big credit to Rapid.
Yeah. Rapid Response.
The city... Yeah. Ramped up cleanups big time about a year and a half ago, and they've kind of kept the pace up, and that has helped a lot. And then on the enforcement end, I know a lot of police officers who have been working really hard because, you know, it's upsetting and offensive to police officers to see crazy things happening in places that should be public and safe for everybody. And so a lot of effort made, and I am seeing positive results. So some of the bad has been pushed out, and you know the more good you can bring in, that also helps a lot. That at Five and Oak, there's a food cart pod that used to be a prime drug dealing spot, stolen cars, and some arrests, and then the establishment of a nice food cart space. And
oh, that's great.
It is clean and nice now.
Okay, so we should all go visit. See, I didn't know about this. We should all go visit that, and there should be more publicity around those good things that we're adding to the city. I think that's great. What else is going on that's good? Let's keep going with this.
We're in kind of a negative media feedback
loop. Yeah.
And, you know, media is driven by desire for content, which I've kind of gotten to see firsthand with them coming to see the fentanyl stuff. And that's understandable. But, you know, we are seeing some progress, making some gains. The hard part is kind of there's a lag in the story and in how people are feeling. And we got more work to do. But we need to end that negative feedback loop. And we do need to help get people down here and excited about being down here again. And the combination of reestablishing some order with bringing in some nice things will help. We've had trouble with shooting ourselves in the foot. And this deflection thing is just another example. We keep generating stories about how dysfunctional we are. And if we could stop that, it would really help. I like downtown. I've loved working down here.
It's never boring.
Yeah.
Good and bad. It's never boring.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people who live right in this, like right near here.
Yeah.
And it's been very upsetting for them.
And it's all incomes. It's all incomes.
Yeah. And they moved here for a reason because they like it and they want to return to the good times. And I think we can get there. But we just got to actually do some tangible things and get the word out.
Yeah. Thank you for running. And thank you for coming in and giving us an update. Eli Arnold, District 4 City Council candidate. Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.